My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Clancy!
I'm very glad to be here tonight. You know, a lot of people don't know this. I seem to have kind of a rough exterior, but I'm kind of a cream puff inside, I guess. Soft, and I don't want people to know that, but I was thinking as I was sitting there tonight listening to John and Dick and Julie and thinking, you know, this may sound corny, but if I had one day left to live, I'd like to spend it listening to those three people talk. Right? It would make it seem like forever. I shouldn't be so smart before they reimburse me for my plane ticket, I'll tell you that. What? I don't know why I'm only invited back here every 10 years. But I'm glad to be here, and I want to, very seriously, I had a difficult day yesterday because I was supposed to come get here to Atlanta in the afternoon and take part in the evening meeting. I mean, listen and share it and so on. And just a week and a half ago or so, we got called into a very, very important meeting with the representative of the mayor of Los Angeles and so on, where I work. And I had to be there for a noon luncheon meeting yesterday. And that really screwed me up. And the meeting lasted until 1:30, and then a guy, a sponsor, picked me up where I work and rushed me to the airport, and I caught a plane at 2:50 for Denver. And then, because of storms and problems, and everything was delayed. I was supposed to get into Atlanta about 11:30 last night. We got in way after 1 o'clock, tired and, down, and got off the plane. I really didn't feel very pert. And your chairman, Mr. Dick, stood there waiting for me at 1-something in the morning with last night's speaker. She was down there looking to see if anybody else wanted to congratulate her. You kind of work in the crowd around United Airlines. I spoke tonight. You want to thank me? But she was there, and I really appreciated seeing both of them, and charming assistant. And they came and picked me up and made everything all right. It really was good. I was glad to get up this morning and slept a little late, but got up in time for the meeting, the old-timers meeting. When you saw all of us old-timers here, it's like being in God's waiting room. Wondering which one will be next. Say hello to Chuck C. But I'm very glad to be back. I love Atlanta, and I love being down here, and I like the people here. I had dinner tonight with my old friend Bill Coveney and saw a lot of friends, and Marcia and her crowd of hideous newcomers, and Mother Goose and her ducklings, and a lot of people who I've known over the years, and Mr. Bill R., well-known old-timer, who just, he and his wife continually beat me out just by a couple years on this. But he's not looking well. But I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime. Dinner tonight and other times during the weekend, a couple of people have mentioned to me kind of an interesting thing. Some of you, I'm sure, saw that A&E special on Alcoholics Anonymous that ran a month or two ago, and that interesting interview in there about the girl who said, "I don't approve of AA. It's all right for some people, but I don't need it because I've written a book called Moderation Management, How Alcoholics Can Drink Again," if they watch their stuff. And they filmed that interview, I guess, in February. And as most of you know, very ironically, she's in jail now in Seattle because she was arrested for criminal manslaughter, driving her car drunk, wrong way in the freeway, and killing a guy and his daughter. And she's now, in her last quote was that she thinking of going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know we're all sick with excitement. When they interviewed me on that thing, I've said this before, but I've got to say it again because you deserve to know. Now, you have to maintain anonymity, of course, you know, and I believe in anonymity. It's a very important thing. It has a spiritual, deep spiritual connotation. But in West L.A., there's a meeting place called Ohio Street, and there's a big lot of windows there. So they wait till the day of the sun's coming in the window, and I was sitting in front of the window, and all sort of could see the silhouette. They asked me questions. And the A&E thing went up there. And I believe in anonymity. I get on television a lot and the papers a lot because of my work, but I'd never as a member of AA. But when I saw that camera going, I know it was going to go all over North America and maybe all over the world. And I could just feel everything in me wanted to go. But I fought it off at the last minute. But the guy asked me some questions to get, I don't know if it's a warm-up or what. They didn't appear on the television program because I guess my answers weren't dramatic enough. But they were interesting questions because they apply to people from this. Instead of the young man over here, he's got his book tonight. I want to tell you something. We are very happy to have you here. And there's a good long life ahead of you if you stay here. And I'm tired of seeing newcomers who look healthier than I do. Anyway, he asked me some questions. And one of the first questions he asked me, you know, usually they ask you puffball questions like, well, how many people are there in AA? How many meetings do you have and where are you? And the first one he says, how come some alcoholics can stop drinking without AA and some have to go to AA? And that's the truth. Some apparently can. And nobody, you know, there are not very many of them, but there are some, and most of them have had them pointed out to us in our drinking days. Why can't you be like Uncle Leo? He used to drink too, and he stopped. And you look at Uncle Leo, and he looked like he hasn't smiled since 1924. But I try to, you know, there definitely are. There are people who seem to be all, by any measurement, alcoholics. But when something really threatens their security, loss of a job, loss of a family, or a death in the family or something, they will quit. I quit! And they will not drink anymore. And there are people like that. There are also people who get physically addicted as well as psychologically addicted. These are the people for whom treatment facilities were originally created, to help people medically get off. And they get taken off step by step. And each step of the way, they're shown what's happening in their life. They, oh, man, I'm glad to know that. And they quit. And that's a particular type of alcoholic. You know, when Bill Wilson wrote this book, he knew there were seemed to be other types of alcoholics. He didn't know much about them, but he knew what they were. That's why again and again in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, he refers to alcoholics of our type. He doesn't say what the other types are or what our type really is. But alcoholics of our type. And what he's referring to, there are people also who have terrible drinking problems, who their security is threatened, a death in the family, they lose their job, they lose their family, something terrible happens, and they quit. And eventually, always sooner or later, begin to drink again. Then there are people who are physically addicted and are taken off medically. They're shown each step of the way what's happening to them, and they're just, look what's happening. Oh, man, and sooner or later, they always drink again. And these are the people that have often always baffled doctors and clergymen and judges and psychiatrists and all sorts of people. Most importantly, they have baffled their families. I bet there aren't very many people in this room who haven't seen that or heard that. And it sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. It's a heart-searing thing. To look at that look of disappointment and sadness again and hear him just say those words, how could you? You promised. You told us you wouldn't do this again. Now look at you. And it really just makes you feel terrible. And I never could find an answer except, get the hell away from me. Leave me alone. Just leave me alone. Get out of here. Because I feel as bad as they do. And I don't know why. And these people are called alcoholics of our type. That's who we are. And most alcoholics are like that. And nobody understands why. There are some people who can stop. And why maybe 95% of alcoholics cannot. But so, and the trouble is, all of us at one time or another have thought we are of that 5%, I'm sure. And thought, I can quit when I'm ready. And you can, but then you always start in again. I didn't know how to explain this to this guy at length, so I just told him, I don't know, there just seem to be some people who can stop drinking, but most people can't. Not a very inspirational answer. I guess he didn't use it. Then he asked us another question. He said, well, why is it that when people, these alcoholics that have to go to AA, and they'll go to AA, how come some of them stay sober and some of them don't? They go to the same AA. Why is that? And think about it. That's absolutely true. And nobody knows why. I'll guarantee you, if this front row here were all new people tonight, and they went to the same meetings, even had the same sponsor for the next year, after a few weeks, a couple of them would be gone, then a couple more, then two or three might be gone and come back. At the end of the year, there might be two or three of them getting a first birthday. And many times, not even the ones you had any idea would be the ones who stayed. The ones that you had the highest hopes for are gone, been gone for 9 months, and some wretched personality problem puke is getting up and saying, well, I'm getting my cake. There he is now. And who can explain that? And he asked me that question. And, you know, it made me think about my own life. I had to think about my own life. I am not a masochist. I'm a hedonist, I hope, of the first water. Not that it doesn't mean much good anymore, but incidentally, I should say this. I've said it before, but nobody here remembers anything I've ever said. Huh? She's still talking. What time does the dance start? Huh? Where's the ice cream? Well, 2 or 3 years ago, I turned 70. 3 years ago, actually, I just had my birthday. And when I was 70, I started to get a little feeling of being old. I don't feel old. I was out playing softball and having fun. But inside of you, you know, you hear the clock ticking. Tick, 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 tick. Any minute, any minute. This may be the day. And my doctor started giving me iron tablets, I guess, for my blood. And no big deal. But about a few months ago, in a fit of renewed vigor, I just tried it for the hell of it. I tried a Viagra. And I had no idea that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. Well, that may or may not be absolutely true. I don't know. I can't remember anymore. Like one old guy in our group says, I take an eighth of a Viagra every morning. And I said, why the hell would you take an eighth of Viagra every morning? He said, just so I won't pee on my shoes. What I mean to say is, I am not a masochist. I'm a hedonist as best I can. And so I got to wonder by myself, when I felt a lot of pain as a young man, was driven to Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of pain, and promised the end of that pain, or at least a cessation of it, and slipped year after 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 year. Started as a kind of a high-bottom drunk. was kind of a medium bottom drunk, up and down. And the last day I drank, I stood in the Skid Row in Los Angeles. My front teeth had just been kicked out in the Phoenix jail. You're from Phoenix, aren't you? I'm going to check your feet for tooth marks. Anyway, it's all very funny now, but it wasn't funny then. I stood there in the light rain falling and sick and desperate and nope. I'd just been thrown out of this mission, and I had. They said, "Stay out of here, you damn bum!" I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Trading Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know? And I saw outside that damn old mission, a light rain falling. Let's think about that today. It was kind of like the light rain that was falling this morning. Incidentally, you want to, just to give you a comparative, last Saturday, I was in the middle of Alaska, and there was a light rain falling. And we were on the edge of a lake in the mountains. We were at a church camp. We lived in log cabins, and I had my own little log cabin, and newcomers brought me chunks of wood for my fireplace. And the convention was sold out. It was 100 people. And nothing but fresh air, just air from the mountains and the ocean, the lake, and I just couldn't wait to get here. There's something about sitting on that 85 by the hour. Now what's going on up there, for Christ's sake? But there was a light rain falling that morning, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what it was, but I have thought about it. You know, I'm sure people in this room have had it. It's the feeling of there is no friendly direction. There's no direction where if I follow that direction far enough, someone's going to be glad to see me. And I just didn't know what to make of it. I just couldn't believe this could be happening to me. I'm too smart. I'm too talented. I thought any minute that my wife should wake me up and say, "Clancy, you're kicked off all your covers. Come on, get up and go to work." But it wasn't that. And I stood there. I didn't just know what to make of it. If some old guy had come up to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothing, all the clothing you had with you. I guess you lost it in Phoenix before that guy arrested you and threw you in jail where the guy kicked your front teeth out. I know he'd done that because my gums were bleeding and my lips were swollen." He said, Once upon a time, you had owned a home recently. You don't even have any place to go now. You can't even get a job washing dishes. You're an only child, and your mother is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you manipulate her and tell her touching stories so she'll send you some more money. Maybe you mean your promises, but you eventually wind up breaking your heart one more time. Now, you've been going to AA off and on for 10 years now. And you sit in these meetings and think you're smug and think you're intelligent and you're better than they are. And you're dying on the street. Why don't you go back one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if some guy had said that to me, and I were in a mood to be honest, which I might or not might have been, but I don't think so. But if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have had to tell him, "Pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I would give anything to be an alcoholic. But I'm not an alcoholic." And if he had said, "Well, prove you're not an alcoholic," I wouldn't be able to do that. I wouldn't know the answer to that question. So I probably would have to say what I sometimes say when people get too close. "Get the hell away from me. Get your face out of my face, you son of a bitch. Leave me alone." I didn't know the answer, but I know it now, why I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. Because I've been going, at that time, I've been going to AA for 10 years. And I knew nothing else. I knew what an alcoholic was. I went to AA meetings off and on. I didn't learn how to stay sober. I couldn't stay sober, but I knew what an alcoholic was. And that kind of begs the question, what's an alcoholic? Everybody in this room knows what an alcoholic is. The new kid over here just got his book tonight. We all know what alcoholics are. They are people who drink, and they seem to drink too much, and they can't handle it after a while. They get in trouble. They have a lot of pain in their lives. They get sent to someplace like AA, and the AA sober them up. They clean up their act, and their lives get better after that. And you hear that at every meeting you go to. Variations of the same story, but it's always the same story. I used to drink, and it was terrible. I came here, got sober, and now it's better. And I have no question that that is absolutely true. And in many ways, I drink like an alcoholic. I've been in jail more often than most of my... I'm not a big felon, but I've been in jail 30-some times because I have a tendency, when I get drunk sometimes, to counsel policemen. I wish I didn't, but if they look at me funny, it is my job to straighten them out. You looking at some blue belly? I'm a taxpayer. Get your ass out of here. You know. And I've lost a lot of things. And in many ways, I look and smell like an alcoholic. But there's one difference that I could never overcome. I don't know if I consciously thought about it at the time, but I knew it in my heart. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And the longer I stay sober, the worse it gets. It's almost as though somebody puts a spring inside my gut, an invisible spring. And as I stay sober every day, they just put a little pressure on it. And I get a little more irritable and a little more cross and a little more edgy. And eventually I have a few drinks to just ease off. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink to ease off because there's something wrong. I know there's something wrong with me. I've known since I was a little boy. And I spent my life disguising it. There's something missing in me. I don't know what the hell it is. But other people seem to be able to recognize it. When they get close to me, they don't seem to like me very well. Or they don't... I can't maintain a one-to-one relationship very well. And people just... I have to keep a front up all the time. Because if people could see what I am, I don't even know what it is, but when they can see it, they don't like it. In fact, after I was sober a while, it suddenly began to dawn on me why I've never been able to maintain a one-to-one relationship those years, and it's been very difficult sometimes in sobriety. Because when you don't feel like you're, when you feel less than enough inside of you, you don't have much self-approval. And so you have to get your self-worth from around outside of you. So all I ever ask of you, if you want to be my friend, just treat me special all the time. I don't know that I'm demanding that, but I demand that. Because if you treat me special, I feel average. And if you treat me average, I feel rejected. And no one's going to treat you special all the time, because it's just one of the marks of acceptance is treating you regularly. But when people start treating me regularly, I know they're starting to get rid of me, so I get rid of them first. I have a very, very long list. I had most of my life a long list of names in my head of people who've hurt my feelings and who I gave the ultimate final punishment to. I denied them my presence for the rest of their goddamn life. But if I were I wish I were an alcoholic. When I got sober, I'd be like these people and feel good. But I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to get to the root of these problems. People in AA say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I loved it. I found ways that I'd been hurt that I never dreamed of. No, but just... I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church in northern Wisconsin. Most of you have never been. They don't have it down here, I don't think, to speak of. I'll tell you about the Norwegians. Last year I was speaking in Oslo, Norway. And they took me up to where my grandfather and his brothers came from in the 1880s and came to America. You just kind of see the farm, the Emsland farm, for God's sakes. And as I looked at it, it suddenly struck me, one of the things that my head is, what's wrong with my head? These people, a whole bunch of Norwegians, left Norway in the 1880s to get out of that damn climate, came to America, and settled in North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they spent the next 50 years saying, Jesus, is cold here too. You know, that's the kind of head I face every morning. But I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, very strict church, but you know, it's the only the main church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and liked it. It's kind of tough, but you know, it's good, but very strict. And in psychoanalysis later, I discovered that it had repressed me. It had repressed me, if you could imagine that. How would you like to find that out about your own church, that you'd been repressed? If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I discovered I'd been hurt by the depression. I discovered I'd been hurt by my parents' lack of nurturing me. They went to work instead of staying home and saw them, seeing to my good, and on and on. I used to rather just think, Jesus, no wonder I got such screwed up emotions, the pain I've known. Now, I'll tell you what it did for me. That colored my life and almost destroyed me. Now, I'm not saying this would happen to anyone else. I'm not describing anyone else, just me. And if the shoe fits, I'll be surprised. But I liked psychoanalysis. I'll tell you why. Of all the major emotions that I've known, and I've known a lot of them, and so have you, I'm sure, I remember thinking most of my life, my emotions may not be different, but I have no coating on me. I mean, everybody else, when you get to the end of the assembly line, there's some kind of a plastic they put over you, so you're not quite so naked, you know. And I must have just got there in terms of, hey, God.
Yeah.
Oh, he's Norwegian, screw him, you know. You can hurt my feelings, not so much now because I've learned to hide it, but all my life, my feelings are easily hurt. I'm always having my feelings hurt. I'm always feeling less. But then, as a man, you can't show it. Did that guy hurt your feelings? No. But I have a new name on my list. I'll get that son of a bitch someday. But on and on and on. But these emotions have always... The worst emotion I've ever had, the most lethal one, I think, is deep-seated guilt. Deep-seated guilt. Guilt of what you've done, some of the terrible things you've done, and even worse and more subliminally, the things you should have done and didn't. I mean, I wish I'd have told Mother, if I only would have if I only would have not done that time, my life, you know, on and on. If I only wouldn't have been in jail when my little boy died, I probably could have saved him, and on and on. And guilt is a hard thing. You can do a lot of things with it, but it's a terrible thing. And it's a suicide thing if you push it hard enough. It was in my life. And psychoanalysis enabled me to get rid of guilt, although I didn't know it at the time. I just thought I felt better, but I found out it made me get rid of guilt. You know how? I began to believe that I was a victim. And when you're a victim, guilt leaves. It is no longer my fault. It was their fault. And if I would have been treated well, if I had been nurtured correctly, if I hadn't run away to sea at 15 early in the Second World War, if those guys hadn't got me drinking, on and on and on. And you go to meetings of ACA, the commercial ACA version, and I've been there a couple times as an observer with somebody who I knew there. And there's no laughter in those meetings. It is a continual recital of pain. But it's worth it to get rid of guilt, by God. But of course, you come to discover something. Every time you find anything good in the world, there's a little price tag for it. There always is a price tag. No free lunches, as they say. And the three little price tags for victimization, of course, are just you must accept the fact that you will continue and intensify feelings of resentment toward those who have done this to you or failed to do it for you. You will also have a feeling of continuing difference. In other words, I heard the ACA guy say this, and I was stuck in my mind. He said, we are like trees. When we were sapling, someone got inside of us and hurt, scarred, badly scarred our insides. We continue to grow, and now we're full trees, but we will never be the same because our insides are badly scarred. And the third little price tag you pay, of course, if you're like me, is when you think about these things, intermittent but intense self-pity. God, if I only would have had a break, if I would have been treated right, if only I would have, on and on. And you think, well, maybe those are little inconvenient things. Maybe it's worth it to get rid of guilt. And they might be for most people, I suppose. But I know in reading this blue book after I was sober a while, and I was thinking about that and thinking, the three most lethal emotions for people like me, and I presume like you, is resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. And why are they so lethal? Because they will justify every drink I take till I die from it, and it will never have been my fault. They don't understand. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know that a lot of people have had tough childhoods and bad childhoods. I felt I had, I didn't talk to my father for 10 years after I was grown up. And I look back and there's so many things. And some people have terrible childhoods. And you certainly have been scarred in your childhood. But the one thing I had to learn here eventually, and I hope you learned here too, if you carry this victimization, that sooner or later, you must come to the realization that was then and this is now. I used to kid Dr. Bob's son. He's an old friend of mine. They called him Young Bob. He isn't very young now. He's almost 80. As old as Bill Roop. But I suppose you're going to be, when ACA first of all, I said, I suppose you're going to be the president of ACA. You know, your original adult child of an alcoholic, and you were there. And he got quite testy about it. He said, no, you misunderstand, Clancy. He says, I do not choose to spend the rest of my adult life in the role of a wounded 16-year-old neurotic. And I said, oh. But I spent a lot of money in psychoanalysis. I read a lot of books. I got into strange... One of the things that carries with you if you've been raised in a strange religion, I mean a strong religion, Lutheranism. I didn't mean strange. I mean it's a good religion. It is a good religion. A lot of people turn down their rights. And is that there's... You always carry a deep-seated down inside of you somewhere a little knowledge that you're going to go to hell. Yeah, I'm going to go to hell. No, I'm not. No, no, no. But at 2 in the morning, you're going to go to hell. And that's that God, in our church, it seemed to me as a kid, and of course that's so misunderstood, but if you broke two or three commandments, you were just on the very edge. And if you broke four or five, it's... Forget it. And I remember when I was new in AA this time telling someone, I've broken all 10 commandments. Don't tell me about God, please. I've broken all 10. Some of them accidentally, but I broke them. And it wasn't until I was sober a couple of years that I realized I haven't broken all 10 commandments, and I've exaggerated that. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Of course, where I live in Los Angeles, we always say, yet. In some of the groups in AA, I understand around the country, they use the steps to separate the men from the boys. Sometimes in our group, we use a crowbar. But anyway. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that. If I'd have been nurtured as a child, I wouldn't have. I was having trouble with God, because if God exists, I am damned. That's one of the reasons when I came back again and again, pretty soon they start talking about God. And I just, if God exists, I'm damned. And it's too bad. I remember sitting in a little group in Chicago, and one of my brief sobriety, and fulminating, they're talking about God, turn your life over to God. And I said, God is a bunch of crap, it's just a superstition. And some little lady came up afterwards to me and she says, "Oh, son," she said, "I hate to see you fight God." I remember thinking, I didn't do it, but I wanted to say, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." You know. Now you can hear me fight God on the old audio for a while. I remember reading about a book by a man named a German philosopher. And he had an interesting concept in his book. Nietzsche, his name was. But he was kind of an anti-establishment guy, and he's cynical, and I liked what he had to say. And I remember reading through, "You're right, Nietzsche, yeah." And you get to the end and discover he died in the insane asylum. You have to go back and find out why. He wasn't really insane, he just died of syphilis. And he just was a good time guy like me, and that's all. "You with anyone, Granny?" Yeah. That's one of the advantages of drinking. Your tastes disappear. Anyway. But one of his things he said, one of the times he wrote, and I remember reading, he said, one of his characters says, "God is dead. Why are you concerned about God? God perhaps set the orbs a whirl, but now there's all about you is anarchy, natural law. There's no God." I think, oh, if he's right, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And in fact, in the theological seminar in Chicago, they have him quoted. It says, "God is dead." Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, unfortunately, it says, "Nietzsche's dead, signed God, 1906. But I had a lot of emotions in my life, and nothing really helped them as much as two or three drinks. And that's why I drink, because drinking makes me feel the way men look. When I was a boy in the South Pacific, 15 years old, run away from home, small, pimply-faced, dumbbell, hitchhiked to San Francisco, I stood outside of Minneapolis. My mother thought I was going to Superior, Wisconsin, to visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me bus fare. I stood outside of Minneapolis. The car stopped. "Where are you going to?" "San Francisco." I said, "So am I. Hop in." And away we went. Turned out he was in the Navy going back to the ship. He just wanted to lower a companion, I guess. And we went all the way. And we'd stop at night. There were no motels. And we'd trailer course. He'd get me a bed. He bought my meals. Listen to just amazing. I wish I who knew that guy was. I never hitchhiked before. I just thought that's the way it was. You tell them where you're going, they take you there. Yeah. And I got out there. He told me I probably couldn't get in the Marines. I wanted to be in the Marines because early in the war. And he said, "You probably get in the Merchant Marine." I got in the Merchant Marine. I got some papers. They were just crying for men and guys. He said, told me how to fill it up, put down 16. I said, "You're only 16, kid. We'll need your parents' permission." So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And the day I got to San Francisco, that afternoon, I was on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. Yeah. I've often thought about that. I was on a ship those days with the scum of the earth. Scum of the earth. I mean, all the good guys had gone in the Navy. These were the scum. Filthy, rotten, dirty, depraved beasts. And I'd hitchhiked all the way across the country, and I was on a ship with depraved beasts. You know, you can hardly pick up the paper anymore without seeing children being molested. That's a dreadful thing. I'm not joking about it at all. It's a dreadful thing. Parents and clergymen and doctors and passersby and teachers. It's just hideous. It's every second child, seems to me. I look back at those days. I hitchhiked all the way across the country. I was on two different ships with the scum of the earth and was never molested once. It makes you feel unattractive. Well, I was in the Navy, I took the war, not in the world, I became out of children, so I had to get drinking. It's the only thing. I felt the way those, and the last day I drank, I felt the way men look, is what I tell. And I drink too much, sick, and people think my drinking is my problem, but it isn't. And nobody came up and talked to me that morning. I just stood in the street corner, and I finally walked out toward an AA club. I'd been in there drunk a few days before. I didn't want to go there, but I had to get out of the rain, and they weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them, and I hung around that damn old club all day, and had a meeting that night, and I drank. I mean, I ate cake and listened to some puke talk about gratitude. Slept that night in an abandoned car in the back of the club. Got up in the morning, came in Sunday morning, heard somebody give a spiritual talk, and ate more cake, and watched it rain. I went to a meeting that night and heard somebody else talk about the steps. So I went to puke, and I went to slept in my abandoned car. Got up in the morning, but it just went on for days. It never stopped raining. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe that minister was right. This is what hell is, just eternity listening to people talk about the 12 steps. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety, because I didn't want it to be. I'd been sober a lot of times for good reasons. Like I mentioned, when my son died, I came out of jail and I stayed sober. I stayed sober so long that it got so bad finally that I committed suicide and was put in the insane asylum. But I didn't drink. And I stayed sober. Stay sober. No reason to stay sober. And I often wondered why that was. I'll tell you, you know, AA has authorities. You may have noticed this. You know who authorities are? They're people who come from a long way away and come and talk. When you have meetings in Georgia, you bring Sharon. And you bring other speakers from far away. And when we have meetings in California, we bring speakers from Georgia and California and New York. And as long as you're from far away, it's him. Will you sign my book? I'm a minor authority in Toronto, Canada. I go there every February, all the way from California, and they have a one-day thing, and I'm featured in the morning. I talk about the history of AA or the traditions or the steps or the concept or something. In the afternoon, they have a question-and-answer meeting, and that night, there's a speaker meeting, and I talk. And I love the question-and-answer part because I've developed, or maybe I've innately always had it, an ability, when they ask me a question, to weave a verbal tapestry while of BS while I think of the answer. Let's go back and study the background of that situation. Yeah. And I just love it. My own voice just lulls me into a sense of love somehow. A few years ago, some woman got in the back and said, Clancy, I have a question for you. If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers. But somebody ought to slap that bitch. But I didn't say anything because I'm too good a guy. I said, yes. She said, every year we hear you come up here and tell how long you slipped and how terrible it was and how sad it was. Now how long you've been sober and how wonderful everything is. What happened? What was the dividing line? Is all you say you go to AA, but what happened? You went to AA a lot of times. And I had to tell her, well, there's no way to answer that in a sentence or two or three. That's ridiculous. You know, I can't possibly. Perhaps I can talk to you later about that. She spoiled my rhythm for the whole afternoon. I just that night I was taking a shower before the meeting, and an answer came. The answer I could have given her, I probably wouldn't have, because it wasn't a very dynamic answer. I like answers that have a little panache, a little body, a little zip. I'd like to have the new people tonight, several of them here. Two girls who met each other again after all this time. Wasn't that beautiful? Anyway, you stole my boyfriend in that bar, you bitch. Yeah. Well, I'd like to have the newcomers leave tonight and say things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said?" "Wet birds don't fly at night." "Yes, but did you hear what Clancy said after that?" "Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." Now, these answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. Unfortunately, the answer I thought of was such a crappy answer. This was the first time I ever felt so bad that I did things that were stupid and not indicated in my life, and I let people who weren't qualified tell me what to do. And not out of any desire for somebody, just because I was tired. And I don't mean wonderful things like, "Work the steps." I mean little things. Like, now in those days, there weren't any cups like this. Everything was porcelain cups. So after every meeting, people had to wash cups. And nobody wanted to do it after a while. So they looked for volunteers. Remember the guy said, "You, without the teeth, you want to wash dishes tonight?" And if I'd had any strength left at all, I said, "No, I don't want to wash dishes tonight." But instead, I found myself saying, "Hey, you want to help us clean up the hall?" "Come on a little early and set up the chairs." And people I wouldn't have hired to mow my lawn were telling me what to do. I stayed sober, but despite them, I just went to make a score. Jesus. Then if you stay sober a while, then of course, what they'll do, as they always do, "Time to get a sponsor. Time to get a sponsor." I was living in an abandoned car. And if you're new tonight, let me tell you about sponsors before it's too late. They all pretend to be so nice. "Oh, we care. We love you." But they'll all eventually stick their nose in your business. And I'd see this guy come in out of the club. He was an actor in the movies, and he played loving roles, character actor, not a star, but he just played people giving people money and helping people. "That's my new sponsor. I'll get some money from him. I'll get some front teeth. I'll get a suit. I'll go to New York. I'll get back writing again. I'll be a success. Somebody will come back and buy this club, and I'll burn the goddamn thing down." I said, "Bob, would you be my sponsor?" "It's a jerk, kid, but I want you to do what I say." "Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis." And he became my sponsor. I felt this many times. He should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just... I felt like Quasimodo. "Want me to ring the bell now, Bob?" And he wasn't always mean to me, but he did give me some crap. And I used to wonder, why would I take crap from that guy? Because I don't take crap from anybody. That's my stock and trade in all those years. I may be up and down, but I don't take crap from anybody. I've left big jobs where I was being paid a lot of money to be a good writer. And somebody giving me too much crap, take your job and shove it. Get yourself another boy. I'm not going to take that crap from you. I don't know how many nights in bars people say, "You don't seem to be very much to me." "You don't think so? Try me, son of a bitch. Let's go." And I get knocked on my can a lot. But they know I'm tough, I'll tell you that. And it wasn't until I was sober a while and listened to a guy tell me about it in a fourth step, fifth step, that I realized, that's me. Do you know why? God, because all of my life I have secretly known that I'm a weakling, and I hate it. I despise being a weakling. I despise weaklings. And I'm a weakling, the weakest weakling of all. And so all my life I had to be especially tough and especially flamboyant and especially everything. So people would, if anybody ever implied I was weak, I had to do something about it. And I had no idea. It cost me so much, that particular aspect of my life. And the funny thing about it, this is, if you're new, maybe have that feeling some night at 2 in the morning, realize you're a weakling and you're nothing. You stay here long enough and take enough of these actions and surrender little by little. One day you become strong, just the way you've always wanted to be. And once you're strong, then you can afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. Funny. But I, you know, I took, you know, I don't know why I took crap in this guy, because you know who I liked? I liked people who liked me. I had no respect for them. I thought they were stupid pigs, but I liked them. I hated people who could see through me, because they knew I was a phony, and I hated that. And that guy could see through me, and I hated him. But he also liked me. I did things to get that guy's approval I wouldn't have done for Jesus. Or my father. Just, I wanted so much to him to approve of me. And I did things, and he got me to take actions I never would have taken in 100 years. And that's why I stayed sober. I finally took the actions of AA. Doesn't seem like very much, doesn't seem to be very dramatic, like big middle of the night breakthroughs and spiritual experiences. That's an interesting thing, you know. In the first edition, the first printing of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, most of you old timers know that, the newcomers don't. The 12th step read differently than it reads now. It said, Bill Wilson wrote from his experience. If you read a big red book, you ever see it, it says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And after the book came out, they went to him and said, Bill, that isn't what happened. You didn't have a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. You had a spiritual experience in the middle of the night in the town's hospital. You didn't even want it. And later on, you created the steps. And later on, you wrote them in the book. How do you explain that? And they didn't know how to, couldn't explain it. And I think somewhere along the line, they begin to get the first glimmers. They watch people stay sober. The first glimmer of what made AA different. And that is this. For the first time in history, there was something where they could bring about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his. Boom! But the way we get ours, most of us. Make amends to that bitch? Are you crazy? And so in the next printing and all subsequent printings, it was as having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. An incremental experience, and that's what came to me. I didn't do very well. My first year, I had jobs and got fired. And this guy, I said to my Bob, right after he came to my sponsor, I said, Bob, I'm living in an abandoned car. I'm eating cake at meetings. Once in a while, somebody will buy me a sandwich. There's one guy gives me an apple and says, someday you can eat this. Get him someday. I'm a sensitive, intelligent, creative man. I can't live like this. What can I do? He said, get a job. I said, Jesus. Look how terrible I look, Bob. He says, get a terrible job. And I did that. And little by little, I remember when I was 6 months sober, I got fired as a dishwasher after 2 days. I'm not defending it tonight, but at the time, it appeared to me that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. Which led me to deduce that they were getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. Well, I guess I miscounted all, but... And that day I was going to commit suicide. And my sponsor cursed me into writing an inventory. I called him. I said, Bob, I just can't. I thought to myself, if I call him and tell him I'm fired, he's going to be just cross. He's always cross. He never liked to hear bad news. And I thought, I used to be an award-winning writer. I wrote Elsie Delmer ads, and I wrote great stuff in my day. And I created the national slogan for Community Chest. And I should be able to write such a touching and beautiful little story for him that even this cold-blooded fool will come down and say, I've misjudged you, here's some money, let me help you. I called him. I said, Bob, this is Clancy. I've lost my job. He said, Bob, what happened? No, wait a minute, Bob. Let me tell you something. You know, mostly being, I've lost my family. I've lost my home. I can accept that. That happens to guys. But there's something you always tell me, age is going to make it better. Let me tell you something you may not know. When you're not around, Bob, people in AA treat me like a piece of crap. They really do. I mean, people, I sit down in the club, have a cup of coffee, and somebody will get up and find an excuse to get up and go to a different table. People tell their newcomers to stay away from me. I'll get them drunk. People won't call on me in meetings. They called me once. They never call on me again. People just treat me like dirt. When I'm talking to you, they'll come up and say hello to me. But otherwise than that, Bob, I might as well be just a leper. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. And I burst into tears, the saddest thing I ever heard. I said, Bob, what am I going to do? He said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? And I just explained to him a week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why should I take it with an out-of-work actor? What's he going to do, say, cut, reshoot that? What the hell is that? That's nonsense. I said, Bob, I explained that. In my judgment, my problem, my guilt, my fear, my despair, my victim, I've been a victim all my life, Bob. Writing it down and reading it just makes it worse. I need something much deeper than that. In my judgment, I need a breakthrough, Bob. I need a breakthrough. And he said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You've been living in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. I came out of that phone booth, boy, my heart was... It's a good thing I turned left. If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in the ocean and drowned myself. I turned left and got back to the club. I said, some of them, here's the paper. I'm going to write my head in my door. I was so upset, I wrote things I never would tell anybody. Somebody said, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? Well, when you're paying that kind of dough, you can't risk rejection. That's why I don't tell you. I don't want some old fool saying to me, you did what? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. And I wrote this whole thing, and I stuck it under the seat of my car, forgot it, and a couple days later he said, come on, I'm going to take your inventory. We went from Santa Monica to Oxnard, he gave me a flashlight, I said, read it. And I read this, oh my God, for 40 miles, just, it read worse than I remember. It's just terrible. I think he's going to make me get out in Oxnard and I'm going to have to walk back and that'll be the end. I may die. I get all that's all, Bob. Are you finished? Yeah. Leaned over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side, and some other puke over there with a flashlight. Now, let me explain this part before I read it. And I'll tell you, it's an amazing thing. As far as I can tell, every good inventory is the same. Now, doesn't that sound strange? I mean, the specifics vary, but they all contain elements that I thought were unique unto me. Lack of self-worth, fear, a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, and occasionally lashing out at the world to punish them for hurting me. And that's why A is the same all over. That's why it works, because it works if you're new at levels you haven't even begun to understand yet. You can't find it yourself. You can't see through the murk to get to it. In the last few years, because I've been active a long time and I keep doing things, I've had the opportunity to do something that most of you haven't had a chance to do yet. The last 3-4 years I've spoken Cape Town and Johannesburg and London and Dublin and Belfast and Paris and Berlin and Oslo and East Russia and Australia for a week and New Zealand and Costa Rica and all over Canada. And you'd think you'd find exotic AA in these places. But except for the accents, you hear the same emotions that each of us have thought that they were unique unto us. It's just startling. It's amazing. And that's why you have to come to accept this works for people like you. And you don't have to accept how it works. All you have to accept is that it works. You know, there's a great... That's why this book says so specifically, action is the magic word. Because action eventually changes your perception of everything else. I eventually was able to hold a job. My sponsor grinded me, get me to do things. I eventually got a better job. Eventually my family moved back after many years. And eventually I came to, one day, found myself praying to a God without thinking he was going to strike me dead. I believe Chuck Chamberlain and other guys like that who said, God loves you if you just get your crap out of the way. And I gave it a try. And I firmly believe tonight that God loves me. And I believe firmly believe that he loves you as much as he loves me, no more, no less. I'm in a situation that most of you aren't in. Yesterday morning, Friday, when I went to work, as I do every morning, I have to step over the bodies of dying men and women, dying from alcoholism, to get to my office. They're laying on the sidewalk. And I go home at night, and I step over bodies of dying men and women. And I think God loves them, too. And it's just too bad that they refuse to open the door and let them in. But that's what, if you're here, you better stay here, because God, it gets bad out there, I'll tell you. And action is the magic word. It eventually changes your perception. But of course, I want to say one thing more tonight. If you're new, probably the most common thing that new people felt, that I felt, and many people I've known, they say, how does it work? Okay, we'll say, okay, very nice. But how does it work? And we have a very cute answer for that. How does it work? Let me read to you. Rarely have we seen a person fail. But that isn't what they mean at all. They mean, why does it work? Why does this stuff work? It doesn't seem to make any sense, really. It's nice, but it doesn't make any sense. Why does it work? And I always think of, in the early 1700s, probably the most lethal epidemic in the world that had been off and on for years was smallpox. Smallpox just killed people. And in those days, they had no idea about bacteria or germs. They thought it might be caused by the moon or by the water or something. They didn't know what the hell it is. I have a book home called Bring Out Your Dead about Philadelphia in the early 1700s, where during the epidemic, they'd drive wagons through the streets. They said, bring out your dead. You'd bring out your mother or your baby and throw them on the wagon. And people just, where do you go? And then it would die down, subside, and start again somewhere else, just on and on. And in England, there was a doctor at that time, a young doctor who was interested in this, and he stumbled onto something that didn't make sense. He noticed that some young women who milked cows did not get smallpox. Now, what the hell would that have to do with getting smallpox? And it turned out they all had something called cowpox. But there were milkmaids who had cowpox who died of smallpox. Why didn't these? And he studied them for a while and he realized there was a slight difference in this kind of cowpox and nobody knows why. But he thought, could there be something? Is there something magic? So what he did, he bought a little boy, 9-year-old boy, named Jimmy Phipps. He bought him from his parents and he took him down to where the girls had cowpox, this type of cowpox. And he had no idea how you transmit disease. No doctor did. But he thought it must be like this. So he cut a little slash in his arm and took some pus off these people, blood and pus, and rubbed it in the kid's arm. And the kid got cowpox and got better. Then he took him down to the smallpox death ward where they're all just dying. That's all. Just dying. And this was put a slash in the kid's arm. This way he didn't use his hand. He knew it was lethal. He took a stick, got blood and pus off a dying person's eyes and rubbed it in the kid's arm. And the kid got very sick and got better. And for the first time in the history of mankind, they discovered there's some way to stop smallpox. They had no idea why or how it worked. And so they tried to get people to do that. Most people wouldn't accept it. That's nonsense. That's superstition. That's ridiculous. It can't be. And a lot of them died. But the people who allowed themselves to get that lived. Interesting little thought. The word for cow in Latin is vacus. That's where the word vaccination comes from, injection of the cow. And it wasn't for 150 years that they finally found out why this was. They discovered that somehow this particular form of cowpox sets up a series of antibodies that negates the smallpox virus. And that's the only way in the world to stop it. And that's, oh, and then it was very easy. In fact, smallpox, until a couple of years ago, was thought to be wiped out in the world. But now there's a few little strains coming back, which are working on. It is my belief, if you're new, that maybe 100 years from now or so, some social scientist, after working in the laboratory for weeks, must say, I think I've got the answer. It turns out that a series of rather everyday actions taken under the direction of a crazed dictator personality sets up a series of reflexes that reduces conflict in the cerebral cortex, makes it unnecessary to ingest alcohol. Oh, doctor, you've done it. But we won't be there to see it, because we'll be dead from old age. So all I can tell you tonight, based on my experience, to you, young man, and you, young girls, and you folks over here I knew, don't worry about how it looks to you, because your judgment stinks. You just come here and take the cowpox, and take the cowpox, and take the cowpox, and by God, you'll be here a long time. Thank you. Yeah.